I'm no tech genius, but I knew if I wanted my business to crush it, I needed a website now. Thankfully, Bluehost made it easy. I customized, optimized, and monetized everything exactly how I wanted with AI. In minutes, my site was up. I couldn't believe it. The search engine tools even helped me get more site visitors. Whatever your passion project is, you can set it up with Bluehost. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, what do you got to lose? Head to Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com to start now.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. Ben, do you manscape?
Dancescape? What'd you say?
Okay, that's a good question as well. I was asking about manscaping.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I shave my, you know, my face hairs, the ones on my neck. Is that what you mean?
Is that what manscaping is?
No, manscaping is usually referring to, addressing hairs, you know, like on your chest.
On my chest?
Or your back. Okay.
No, I don't do any of that.
Okay. Christy, any manscaping?
No, but I've talked to many women, premenopausal and menopausal women who do chinscaping.
Chinscaping.
Oh boy. Yeah.
Oh
about
yeah.
Lipscaping, upper lipscaping.
Especially when they're at like red lights, you know, like have you ever seen somebody just plucking a hair at a red light?
At a
hysterical.
Red light.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Wow.
100%. 100%. Yeah.
We do have, it's interesting, I guess, the, it's kind of an obsession with hair. Maybe.
I don't know, I'm just thinking about it.
It's like, it's natural thing to have hair grown out of your body, but like, we're like, no, not there, over here.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We try to make it behave.
My wife is so grossed out by like stray random hairs. Mm-hmm. Where they shouldn't be. If she sees hair in the shower or in her food, it's a huge ick.
I do understand the hair in the food thing.
Yeah, that's gross.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
I'll allow it.
All right. Christy, how are you doing?
I'm good. Good. Yeah, Colorado, I mean, sunny and happy.
Sunny and happy.
Yeah.
This is the perfect time of year right now. So
yes.
I'm wearing like a sweater, but like I have a tank top underneath because in like 4 hours, it's going to be like 75 degrees.
Yeah.
So it's perfect.
75 degrees.
I feel that.
Is that the high today for you?
I think so. Okay. Sunny, 75 nice. And sunny.
Nice.
Boy. Well, we've been having that kind of weather too, Ben.
Have you?
It's been good. Well, it gets up into the 80s, which, you know, if I'm in a quibble, that's what it'll be about. Say like, let's just settle down a little bit. Stay in the 70s. Why don't you?
But it
is. The evenings are starting to get cooler. I really like it.
Mm-hmm. The weather's good, I guess. You can say.
Oops.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you doing?
Sorry. Just
we're recording a podcast.
I don't know. We just grabbed something on my desk and it grabbed something else.
All right.
I can't. Well, these things.
Christy,
edit this out.
Christy, you're starting a new formation course soon, yeah?
Yes, I am. It's like a week away and super excited. I just like truly. It's some of my favorite, it's like my favorite hour and a half of the week. Mm. I just really enjoy it. I love being with people who are being intentional. That's like kind of my love language. but I feel like cohorts are, people come and they're like, hey, I want to be real. I want to be intentional. I want to learn. Mm. I want to process. And so yeah, Thursdays, it's going to be great.
Yeah. Cool. I'm in this, kind of a masculinity working group to talk through what does it mean to be a man and how do we reclaim masculinity in a redemptive, healing, wholesome way, you know? And we were chatting yesterday about on this group about how men rarely have spaces where they can be vulnerable about their shame. Mm. That those spaces are rare. And I was thinking, I think I agree, but some of the most generative places where I've seen men deal with their shame is in our formation course groups.
Yeah.
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 I mean, it's pretty incredible. I don't know. I'm just really thankful that, Christy, you lead groups, we lead groups, and yeah. I think they do really good work.
Yeah. There have been probably some of the most vulnerable moments. It's wild that people can kind of just share their heart and it be trusted in that group, which is what I really love.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Even at a distance, I know, you know, most of these groups are done on Zoom just because we get interest from, you know, kind of all over the country and sometimes all over the world. And we, you know, assemble these groups as they come together. But yeah, I've frequently been surprised by how quickly and how deeply the groups form into like a really safe, loving community that a lot of people, there's not a space in a lot of other people's lives where that is the case, where they can just say what's real and without fear of, you know, people being freaked out or repercussions or all of that kind of thing. It's a pretty great environment.
It is cool, like the last two cohorts, so like the last basically 2 years, those different groups have continued to meet like without me. It's not every week. I think it's like once a month or something, but they still, I mean, there's a real friendship there and they still process stuff together, which I think is beautiful.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I'm trying to get a group started as well, but we need a few more people. And so if that sounds interesting to you, listener, you can check out more information at gravitycommons.com/formation. It's got all the info about the course. I guess we haven't talked about like what it is. So if you're unfamiliar with it, it's essentially a group. They meet, we meet pretty much weekly for about a year and it trains you. We've got a method that we've developed, a process, some tools, et cetera, to be able to train people how to notice how God's already at work in your life, in your ordinary life, so that you can participate more fully in this life that God shares with us. And so, it's kind of the basic stuff of Christian faith when you say it that way. But I think it's something that a lot of us, I never learned how to do it. You know, I learned how to hold my faith as a set of beliefs that I was supposed to convince other people about. But I never learned, as a young person at least, I never learned how to actually notice God with me in my ordinary life and notice what God was doing and saying. Even like the charismatic church environment I grew up in, which was, you know, we believe that God was active and working in the world, but it was primarily through miracles, through extraordinary, you know, like big passionate worship services. Like that was the arena in which you looked for God's activity, not your ordinary life. And so most of us have to learn how to do that, to say, well, how is God at work? Just the normal humdrum of my life.
Anyway. You want to hear something cool? Is a girl that I meet with on a regular basis, just one-on-one, like a mentoring relationship. I taught her the Grace and Truth Matrix, which is one of the tools that we use in our cohort. Probably like, I don't know, 6-9 months ago. And she's like getting a tattoo of it on her arm, like in this creative way. Like it doesn't say all the things like call out, hang out, but it does say Grace and Truth, and it's in like the Matrix form. And anyway, I'll have to send a picture because I'm like, this is so cool. She's like, it has marked my life. It is different. It like my life is different because of this. And so anyway, all that to say, I do think that what we learn and what we process in there and how we learn it is life changing. So.
Yeah, well, check it out if you're interested. That is one of the ways that you can support the work of Gravity. And we're talking about that a little bit because we've decided, if you've listened to this podcast for a minute, you know that normally there's going to be ads that run in the middle of the podcast to try to, you know, help fund the ministry, that kind of thing. But we've decided to just go away from that. So there's going to be no ads in this podcast that you're listening to. And from here on out, as long as we discern this is the right thing, but rather than sort of, you know, relying on, you know, random companies or whoever, you know, to kind of like advertise at you, to try to support this podcast, we thought let's just see if we can support the work that we do, which is not just the podcast, but we do a number of other things, including leading these formation groups. And there's all kinds of stuff. We'd, you know, book clubs, learning communities, and we have the online community, the Gravity community. But let's see if the participants in those things can help us fund the work that we're doing. So anyway, if you've been thinking about that, that's now's a good time to jump in. So check out the formation course. Check out, if you go to gravitycommons.com/partner, there's other ways that you can give, like set up a monthly gift to support us. You can become a paid member in the Gravity community. That's another way to support us. And yeah, reach out if you have any questions, but that's what we're doing.
We just finished up a book study. And in a couple weeks, we're going to start a learning community, like a class, and we're calling it Discipleship in the Sheets.
Yeah.
Scandalous.
Scandalous. We're going to talk about sex.
I thought we were talking about sleep.
Nope. Sex, gender. Sex. Oh. Sexuality. We're going to talk about, we're going to talk about all the ways that we hear about biblical marriage or biblical manhood or biblical womanhood. We're going to talk about, LGBTQ issues and how those texts are interpreted from people who hold a traditional view of human sexuality and how they're interpreted by people who hold what's called a reformed or open and affirming interpretation. I think this class is going to be amazing, not just because I'm pulling it together, but because I honestly think that it's so hard to talk about, going back to male shame, it's so hard to talk about things that deal with our deepest vulnerabilities and usually our bodies and our sexuality. Yeah. They are the arena of so much fear.
So,
if that sounds interesting to you, join us. Join us for it.
Yep.
Sign up for the comments. Maybe Ben will drop a link in the show notes.
Yeah. Just go to gravitycommons.com/community.
You can do that too.
And then, then you'll be on our email list and you'll get all the deets when we figure out how and when we're going to offer that. We don't know yet. So.
Being prepared. Yeah. I'm prepared to introduce our guest, Ben.
Who is it?
Her name is Michelle Van Loon. She has been a regular contributor to Christianity Today and In Touch magazine. She's written a number of books previous to the one we're discussing today, including Becoming Sage, Cultivating Meaning, Purpose, and Spirituality in Midlife, and If Only, Letting Go of Regret, which won an award of merit in the 2015 Christianity Today Book of the Year Awards. Today, we chat with her about her latest book, Downsizing, Letting Go of Evangelicalism's Non-Essentials. Let's get into this with Michelle.
All right.
Michelle Van Loon, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thanks, you guys, for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Me too. So we're talking about downsizing, and in the intro, you tell us a bit about your unique spiritual journey, how you grew up, how you came to identify with evangelicalism. And I wonder, by way of intro to this, to our podcast audience, if you could share some of the more salient parts of that story with us.
Absolutely, I'd be glad to. So I grew up in what I sometimes describe as kind of a Jerry Seinfeld adjacent Jewish family. So some religious practice, but mostly pretty assimilated and secular. And it was, as I was heading into my teens, it was when the Jesus movement of the late 60s and early 70s kind of washed over, particularly America and American churches, and certainly as well in the West. And I had friends coming to school who were talking about Jesus, and I was like, well, he's for you, he's not for me. I had a very clear sense of my own Jewish identity. And eventually through months and months of conversation and my own spiritual restlessness and wrestling, I eventually found my way to beginning to read the Gospels. The first time that I read the Gospel of John, where Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me," from John 14. It was as though all the wrestling that I'd been doing, both about who I was and who God was, I didn't understand how Christians could talk about how God had a son when I grew up praying the Shema. There was one God. The plurality seemed very mind-bending to me.
Yeah.
Until it wasn't. And I didn't pray a prayer or any of those other kinds of things about making a decision. Just, I didn't believe at the beginning of my first reading of the book of John. And by the time I got to the end, I was fully committed. But it didn't go well with my parents, as you might imagine, and for all the right reasons. We have 2,000 plus years of terrible anti-Semitic history that included, more recently, the pogroms and the Holocaust. So my kind of commitment to Jesus was a huge slap in their face, even though they weren't religious. The end result of that was that they said, as long as you're under our roof, you can't go to church. And they kind of hoped to starve it out. And that might have worked. Fads pass, bell bottoms pass, bright blue eyeshadow passes, but which were all a thing back in the kind of early and mid 70s. But I had very good sneaking skills because I was a teenager. So I would sneak to Bible studies. I had some Christian friends at school. I listened to the Moody Bible Institute radio station just to listen to sermons. But when the music came on, it was that was a bridge too far for a metal loving teenage girl like me. So then I would switch to the album rock station of my choice. I lived in the northwest suburbs of Chicago, so I did have a couple of pretty good options. And that is how I, that was my discipleship kind of launch, was kind of guerrilla approach to faith and life. And I continued that until I went to college. And that's where the book begins.
Yeah. You know, very different cultural backgrounds, but I was raised Roman Catholic. And in college, I fell in with some Protestant Christians. And when I came home talking about, you know, being Protestant, going to a Protestant church, my family, my mom specifically, responded very much the same. very much the same. And I remember doing very much what you did, Michelle. Like I spent time listening to radio preachers because that was the only access I had to the kind of formation and input that I was desiring. Eventually, both of us found our way into the broader evangelical sort of movement in the U.S. And you and I spent time at the same graduate school, the same seminary, and attended church. I think you attended church with me for a while.
Yep, I did.
And it seems like that was 15, almost 20 years ago. And it seems like back then that I kind of knew what evangelical meant and evangelicalism was. But now it seems like there's a, it's a contested term and a contested identity. There's people vying for, there's people vying to control the meaning and the boundaries of what that is. So you, your book is about evangelicalism and letting go of some things within that tradition. Could you maybe, just to get our bearings, could you tell us what you mean when you refer to evangelicalism? And then how does that go beyond a merely religious identity in your mind?
Right. Well, in a lot of ways, there are some core definitions that work more in academic settings than in popular or populist evangelicalism, you know, about kind of the academic definitions include a deep commitment to scripture, often a crisis-based decision point that, like I had, and it sounds like you may have had, that kind of launched you into a born-again life. Those pictures of what evangelicalism is have lots and lots of different applications. Fundamentalism looks very different than what has now been dubbed the New Apostolic Reformation. I've done some laps in lots of different evangelical settings over the last 50 years that I've been identified as a Christ follower. And so the rules, the vocabulary, the cultural kinds of what works and what who's in and who's out, where those dividing lines are, can be very different, but there's always lines, and the lines are a lot about what the book ends up talking.
I'm no tech genius, but I knew if I wanted my business to crush it, I needed a website now. Thankfully, Bluehost made it easy. I customized, optimized, and monetized everything exactly how I wanted with AI. In minutes, my site was up. I couldn't believe it. The search engine tools even helped me get more site visitors. Whatever your passion project is, you can set it up with Bluehost. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, what do you got to lose? Head to Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com to start now.
Yeah, and so you use the word downsizing to describe getting clear on what lines are faithful and what mm-hmm. lines aren't, what lines are helpful and what lines do unhelpful work. I know sometimes authors aren't in control of the titles that are selected for their books, but it seems like you embrace this word. So what are you trying to capture or communicate by this action or activity of downsizing, and why is that so important?
I think for me, one thing that has saved or preserved kind of the core of my faith has been my lifelong study and interest in of church history. I was obviously a very self-directed, motivated learner about all things that had to do with faith from the time I was a teen. And I was kind of amazed. In evangelicalism, church history is at best kind of a handmaiden that is pulled out only when the narrative fits a particular thing. Typically, church history is there's the Bible, then maybe Martin Luther and some of the other Reformation characters, and then fast forward to Billy Graham, and then the founding of our particular non-denominational church. So the timeline is mostly blank. And for me, understanding that culture, political power, all of those things had ebbs and flows that changed the way that the church, the always reforming church, I'm not reformed in my theology, but the notion of a church that's always being reformed kind of helped me hold on through what has often been a very harrowing journey through all kinds of evangelicalisms. And so that downsizing metaphor, we can look at stats depending on who's doing the counting, and the church is shrinking in a lots of sectors, and depending on how things are being measured, you know, whether it is through specific church membership or whether it's just through kind of social and political identity, evangelicalism has had its moment and has conflated often with politics and is at the same time shrinking in lots of quarters. And for a triumphalistic kind of approach to faith, shrinking is not something that people know what to do with. So that metaphor for me was very powerful. The theologian, the late theologian, Phyllis Tickle, used that notion of every 500 years or so, the church goes through a big rummage sale, you know, and kind of cleans and right-sizes itself through shifts in theology, through the effects of the things that are happening in the world around as well. And we are due, or even overdue, the last big seismic shift in the church happened during the Reformation and Counter-Reformation. That was about 500 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you're not necessarily talking about people leaving the church, although statistics are showing in the last 8 to 10 years, upwards of 10, 15 million evangelicals have walked away from church for a lot of reasons, right? Some people just sit and go back after COVID. Some people are being pushed out or squeezed out. Some people are unable to reconcile the predominant, you know, white conservative MAGA Christian expression, Christian nationalism with their conscience. But you actually talk about various, I don't know if we'd call them rooms or branches, I'll let you pick the metaphor, of the evangelical, the larger evangelical heritage in each chapter. And I'll just name a few. This isn't exhaustive. You talk about dispensationalism and parachurch and the prosperity gospel and revivalism, among others. I wonder if you could pick just one of these topics that you cover and give us a taste of what downsizing looks like. For you personally, just so we can get a feel of the thrust and work of your book.
In each of these chapters, because I've been so many places, like Johnny Cash, I've been everywhere, man, just about, it feels like, from super, super conservative Plymouth Brethren, hyper-dispensationalist fundamentalism, all the way to the place where our lives intersected, Matt, in the ACNA world. And lots of stops in between, several laps with charismatics. And honestly, for some of them, some of these streams or branches, I'm not sure much should survive outside of the essence of, for example, what gets translated into what we say when we say creeds. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. You go through those kind of core beliefs, and I don't think any creed actually captures it all, or if that makes any sense. But the rest of the circuses that have often grown, the bad theology that's emerged that has often been a syncretization of, you know, the American dream, aspirational kinds of behavior with the gospel, which ends up making it neither. Those kinds of shifts should not surprise us. It's the language is there in scripture for that as well. It's called pruning. And a lot of the pruning that is going on as people leave for around politics, around bad theology, around bad practice, abuse. I'm a survivor of spiritual abuse. That's there in the book as well. Those things all point to what needs to go. It does. None of it needs to stay. The effects of it are there, but until we rightly kind of recognize that most of this stuff needs to go, only then can we ask what's next and how do we participate in that. I'm going to be 66 in a couple of weeks. I'm not going to live to see how it all goes, but I want to be a part of what helps people begin to think about what's coming next, kind of midwifing for the next generation, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. So there's like a move towards, you use the word pruning. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could speak a bit, because I think you do a good job over the preponderance of the chapters to differentiate downsizing from something like becoming sectarian or insular. Mm-hmm. That we're not sort of retreating into a remnant sort of fundamentalist, rigid posture. Could you just say a few more words about how this pruning, this reckoning, mm-hmm. is not a move towards insularity or sectarianism?
Right. And that's the temptation is there. Just like a lot of my friends, people I'm connected with that are in the full-on deconstruction community, just the temptation is there for some to translate one kind of fundamentalism for another. And I'm not advocating that a lot of times there is babies being tossed with bathwater. I'm advocating looking for what is life out of what we've done. And it's humbling and shocking for a lot of us who want to do this kind of spiritual work, the reckoning, to realize how much we've invested in things that just don't matter. A good illustration, I was on staff at a non-denominational third wave charismatic church in Wisconsin before I met you. And I was, one of my jobs was to do community outreach, and they had an Easter egg hunt every year to reach out to the surrounding community and try and convince them to come to our church that had all kinds of really pretty shocking, at times, charismatic excess going on. My husband was a seminary student at a Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and both of us were readers and thinkers, so we were always like, can we open our Bible? Can we ask questions about what's going on? That was very annoying to many. But my job was to put on this Easter egg hunt. Who better than a nice Jewish girl to put on an Easter egg hunt? And there was one year where we were supposed to hide these neon plastic Easter eggs outside. Well, it had snowed the night before. But they said, no, we need to do it. Everybody expects that we have this fun hunt outside. So the absurdity of doing what we'd always done, this very frivolous, silly activity that never netted anybody new actually coming to church, was putting neon colored Easter eggs in bright white snow for the children to hunt for. Well, there was no hunting. The eggs were like, pick me, because they were all the color of the 1980s. And so, like, neon, it has its place, but that fashion ship has sailed for me. And that that was kind of a metaphor for, there's a whole lot that we're doing that we think is doing something or is meaningful or is connecting with people evangelistically. And it isn't. I ended up having an uncomfortable, very uncomfortable staff meeting with people. And I said, now let's track how much we've spent, how much energy we've put into this. And I'm not even saying that people need to stay at our church, but are we even getting people willing to visit this church as a result of all of this? And the answer ultimately was no. And long after I left, I saw they were still continuing to do it because whatever. That needs to, that kind of thinking needs to be downsized and exorcised from all of the evangelicalisms that are out there.
Yeah. I was going to ask you to maybe reflect on as we close here to share maybe one or two ways that you've worked through your own personal downsizing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Michelle at 35 versus Michelle at almost 65. How was it hard? What was freeing about it? And in what ways is it still ongoing?
It needs, if we are people that are always being formed and reformed, this is an ongoing kind of narrative, just as pilgrimage is an ongoing narrative that kind of defines our spiritual formation. So it's disconcerting, particularly when you hit kind of the end of what is making sense. The questions get too big. The pain of broken relationships gets too big. The effect of bad theology gets too big. It is an ongoing process. There have been points in my life where I have come to a screeching halt. Like, do I need to kind of assess if there's a sunk cost fallacy happening that is keeping me hanging on here when it just everything about being associated with evangelicalism feels stupid and wrong? Ultimately, no. The God that I encountered when I was a teenager, in his word and from people that weren't holding the microphone and weren't calling the shots, but honest to goodness, people whose faith seemed alive, kept my faith alive. And like Peter, and I think like a lot of people who hit, kind of find themselves in the whirl of deconstruction, where else am I going to go? What Peter said to Jesus, you know, you alone hold the words of life. Does this church contain those words well? Does this community that I've been a part of? Maybe not. Maybe there is no life. Maybe it's an Ichabod moment of, you know, that God's spirit has departed, or at least my journey with God means shaking the dust off my feet and owning it as not as a sin or a weakness or a failure. The relationships get lost. Some of them don't survive a transition out of a church. And there's so much grief with that. But that grief is also kind of a marker of what's worth preserving. The love that is true of who God is. And so we're in a mainline church attending now, but with all of that life experience. So it feels in some ways like my husband and I teach occasional classes there. I'm on their discipleship team. But there's a little bit of an arm's length for the institution, any institution at this point. So I'm there connected with an institution, but my fellowship is not necessarily all under one roof. It's with lots of different people meeting God over a conversation like this.
Right. Yeah, like this. You know, Michelle, I think this is one of the reasons why your book is helpful and necessary, is because so many of us are in a very similar place where the local institution has failed us, or we have embarrassing sort of detours on our pursuit of Christ, where we, you know, are maybe swayed by the new apostolic, you know, Reformation or other things that we now find to be unfaithful or deficient and in ways to pursue Christ. And so we want to move away from that, but we don't want to move away from Jesus, because we did encounter Christ. And he's hard to quit, you know, because of how persuasive and beautiful he is. And so your book puts to words that journey and names, I think, some of names, and by naming gives permission to sort of let go of things that need to be let go of without letting go of Christ. If that's where you're at, if you're looking for a way in, it's a gift. So I appreciate you spending time with us today, Michelle, and for writing this book. Before we go, can you just name maybe where people can find you online and see what else you've written?
So many words. That's what I've been writing most of my adult life. So there's lots of words. My website that kind of shows, this is my eighth book, the one that we're talking about, that highlights the books and other articles, curriculum, plays. I have quite a mutt of a writing resume, is found at Michelle Van Loon, two L's in Michelle, VanLoon, like the car, like the bird. That's one way. I also, because this is the year of our Lord 2025, I have a Substack, and you can find me at Michelle Van Loon there as well.
Yeah. The book, again, is called Downsizing, Letting Go of Evangelicalism's Non-Essentials. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.